is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. This is recorded, though, so if you call in, nobody will answer you.
Welcome in our great guests, our esteemed panel, the MGO Blog Roundtable, Brian Cook from MGO Blog. Brian, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
He looks pretty steamed.
Steamed? I said esteemed.
Esteemed, oh, Greg.
No, esteemed.
We're off to a great start.
We have...
Esteemed now.
from the Power Rank, powerrank.com, Ed Fang, how are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be bumped up to esteemed because it's usually only Craig, right? He usually only gets... Oh, he's the venerable
He's
one,
the venerable
which
one,
is like
right.
esteemed, right?
He's just like old.
But I've been bumped up to esteemed for this show and looking forward to actually having something to say about hockey today.
There you go. All right. And then Craig Ross. Yeah. Do you have a title for your latest book, or do you just write an income?
Oh, I thought you were asking you if he was
book the book I'm writing right now is called... Football When Dinosaurs Walk the Earth. And or at least that's my
is that working title.
That's a working Great. Title. I'll let Seth change it at some point. But yeah, that's what I'm working on. But the it's been fun reading old newspapers and reading the writing about football back in the 1880s. You know, I want to say two things. One, that everybody probably knows that Brian's podcasts are really good and really amusing, and he and Ace do a phenomenal job. But so are Ed's. And
you're pretty good too, Sam.
We appreciate that.
But so are Ed's. So check out his podcasts. They're fascinating at his site.
So if Craig could ever promote himself,
I know, man.
Like
he's
really good all of us.
Yep.
I mean, you'd be on to something, Craig. Be on to something.
How about your book
that.
Could be... The best football book about
dinosaurs?
Football in the 1800s.
I think you should just title it Football When I Was About 30.
There you go. I think I'll do that.
So, guys, we're gonna get into hockey. We're gonna spend a great deal of this hour kind of breaking down the matchup, getting you guys' thoughts on Michigan's chances. But let me get your postmortem, if you will, on the basketball season on the championship game, starting with you, Brian.
Well, you know, this is a unexpected joy of a team, but they ran into a buzzsaw. And they didn't shoot well. I think that, you know, their offense was about as good as you could hope. They shot 66% from two. You know, they didn't turn the ball over particularly much. And I thought of those first 18 threes, of which three dropped, I thought those were mostly good looks. And then you have DiVincenzo, like, throwing it off the backboard to himself and then shooting a three with his eyes closed and, like, I don't know.
Well, hey, DiVincenzo is a hell of a player. I mean, if you saw the semifinal game, I thought he was the best player on the court in that game.
It was pretty annoying that Twitter was like, oh, this Michael Rapoport is ripping up Michigan, lol. And I'm like, dude, he's going to be a first-round draft pick at some point.
Yeah, I mean, think Klay Thompson. Yeah. I mean, that's who he reminds me of. And that guy's a hell of a player.
Which is Beilein. I was like, man, they redshirted him.
Well, he broke his foot during his freshman year.
Oh, well, that's...
So that was part of... And they could have brought him back towards the end, but they're like, no, why would we do that?
But he was a real Beilein type find because he was a three-star, like, ranked 120th or something out of Delaware.
Yeah, around 120, like, exactly
that's,
right.
I mean, he goes up and then he, like, pulls off the Trey Burke block against Charles frickin' Matthews.
Well,
okay.
I mean, it's
that
one thing.
My attention.
That was the most impressive thing that he did.
I mean, it's one thing to have a hot shooting night, but the biggest indicator that guy can play at the next level was that block, right? Because Charles Matthews can fly.
Yeah.
And he got up above him.
And the other thing is, in the semis, he was a phenomenal rebounder. He was a good rebounder.
He's a good player. We can talk about Michigan.
Okay, well, we'll talk about Michigan. But I mean, Villanova was an excellent team, and you're right. We're 3 of 23 from 3. If we shoot the ball at all, you know, this is still a game. I mean, they're 2 of 13 from 3. We're 4 of 13, and we're missing.
I thought it was the other way.
So we're 6. I mean, if we make 4 out of 13, which isn't a remarkable number, and Brian's correct. They were mostly really good looks. And we make free throws. Okay, we don't make free throws. The game is tied or even a little bit ahead because we had a garbage goaltend call at the end
of
the half.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like that should have been a game, and it wasn't a game because Michigan couldn't hit the broadside of a barn from three.
I think that is it in a nutshell. I'm not as caught up in DiVincenzo because I felt like it was going to be someone on that team.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Was going to go off. I mean, you know, we talked to Val Jordan on the show. The game they won, Jalen Brunson went for like 32, 33 or something like that. Someone's going to erupt from that team with so much offensive talent. What it boiled down to for me is, you know, one of the things I said before the game, you gotta make, but you gotta score with this team on some level. Yeah. And at halftime, the stat you just gave, 4 for 13 from three. I know DiVincenzo was 3 for 4, but as a team, they were 4 for 13. If you're Beeline, you're like, hell yeah.
That's about what
you could expect.
And the fourth was a pull up 2 for 1 from Brunson,
right?
Which I was just like, oh,
not even a It was a smart shot, but not a particularly good shot.
Yeah, well, half of their makes. So DiVincenzo had 3 makes off the bounce that were pretty far behind the line.
Yeah, at least 3 feet.
And then
feet.
Brunson had that one. So half of their makes were kind of like you throw your hands up and like, what do I do with that kind of shots.
In fact, we ran them off the line reasonably well, and we played good defense, and we didn't make the mistake that Kansas made in the
Kansas
was a joke. I mean, Kansas is coached at a ridiculously poor level. I mean, they double teamed.
Fairly good.
They
double
team Brunson, and they're down like 12-4. They call a timeout.
22-4.
They call a timeout when they're down like 12-4, and I figure they're doing it to say, okay, we can't double team him because they're just getting wide open threes. No, they still double teamed him, and then it's 22-4, and then they go into a zone or something. The game's over at that point.
I mean, same point.
It was just terribly coached. Michigan did not make that mistake. It was coached right.
Well, they were never going to. They place a really high priority on, you know, preventing threes and heavily contesting the ones that do go up.
They considered it. You know, it was something that, I mean, you have to. Is it something? Do we have to be focused on stopping him to the extent, because he's such a tremendous post player.
Right.
That was one of the things that Val says, man, I think he's the best post player in the country. I thought it was a little bit of high hyperbole, but he said, no, we played him 3 times. He is the best post player in the country, and he can carve you up passing out of the post.
But also, I thought it was interesting. Like, he didn't try to take Simpson off the drive at all, because I think he knew, or Villanova knew, that that wasn't going to be their advantage. They went straight to the post, first couple possessions, got some buckets. He took him. I mean, he took him twice to the basket. One, he got that ridiculous push-off call, or the block call against Simpson.
Yeah,
I thought their game plan was good. I mean, they put Xavier Simpson in shots where he was ineffective, right?
Yeah, like, Brunson had 9 points, and needed 13 shots to get those 9 points. I thought the way Michigan approached Brunson was
perfect.
Good.
I agree.
Perfect.
And I thought X did a great job on him. Really.
It's back to X.
His dad calls him X.
So
we can call him X. Okay. I thought he did a remarkably good job on Brunson, and we actually checked the line very, very well. It's just that they just said, okay, you're checking us at the line. We're just going to move back 3 feet.
Yeah.
And we'll still. But the truth is that, they averaged 29 a game. I think they got
27,
so that wasn't too bad. And they shot it below their season average. I think they were 37-38%. Mm-hmm. It just came down to
the
fact that
makes were just like, well, what do I do with that?
Yeah.
Right. And they're going to make some of those.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is we just couldn't shoot the ball.
Yeah, 3 for 23 is the. If you just, I think the stat was they as good a defensive team as they are, they give up 30%, and so if Michigan just shoots 30%, that's 4 more threes.
Yeah,
it's a different ball game. It's a different ball game.
And
so
they
couldn't shoot.
That's the 3-point lottery.
Yeah, but you can't we should have missed those free throws.
I understand.
But 3 for 20, that's 13%.
Yeah,
dude.
It's bad.
There's only one game in the last 5 years that Michigan has shot that level or worse, and that was last year's South Carolina game. If you remember that.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Well, I'm sorry for bringing it up.
it was not a good game. And that was on the road, too, but still.
Against a
good defensive team.
A really good defensive team. Mm-hmm. And we just that was a game where they didn't get good looks. They didn't get looks in that game. This game, they got good looks that they couldn't knock down.
Yeah, I thought every shot they took in the first half was a good shot. And then you kind of got, like, I think the last four or five were pretty rushed and ugly shots.
Yeah, but they panicked. And
well, you know, you're down that much. Yeah. That's what you should be doing, because yeah. that's what you need to do, is you need to hit a bunch of miracle threes. But, yeah, I thought of the first 18, like, I didn't think an inordinate number of them were bad, because you're always going to get some bad looks at the end of the shot clock. I thought maybe two or three were bad, and Michigan should have expected to hit their season average at least on those shots, and they needed to have, you know, a 40% shooting game from three to win that. And they got nowhere near that. And then, like, the tough thing to me is, like, they ended the season on a tear. Like, that Penn State game, the Maryland game, Big Ten tournament, except for the Iowa game, they were very, very good. And then in the tournament, they had one game where they shot acceptably from three.
Texas
A&M.
Well,
they shot pretty well from that.
Yeah,
well,
but 13 of 23 on A&M or something like that.
Headed into the tournament, they had five of their six games, they shot at their season average or better in a lot of tough situations. Those were all road games or neutral games. Two of them were against, you know, Penn State. And most of them were against tourney-level opposition.
Right.
They get to the tourney, and it's just like, sorry.
Well, I mean, the Loyola game wasn't much better. I mean, our backcourt in Loyola was 1 of 13. Yeah,
2 of 17.
How do you get 2 of 17? I get 1 of 13, but whatever. Wait, either way, it's been good.
I mean, Mo hit both shots. Rock hit both shots.
Yeah.
It wasn't Z or X.
Yeah, I mean...
We know who you're talking about.
Yeah, but, yeah, and Loyola, I mean, we just shot it terribly in that game. We're 7 of 28 as a team, I know that, in that game. So we
from 3?
From 3.
Yeah, okay.
From 3, because they were 1 of 13 from 3 in that game in the backcourt.
Yeah, 2 of 17 was all their shots.
Yeah, and the one was Simmons. Simmons made a key three in the, you know, and beyond that, we just didn't shoot it in that game at all. And that was a miracle that we won that, because Loyola decided in the last 10 minutes they were just going to throw the ball out of bounds for no apparent reason over and over.
Well, I wouldn't.
I mean, we played great D. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, they were in catch 22. They could only score when they had Krutwig in the game. Right. And, you know, with Krutwig in the game, they can't defend Mo.
Right.
So,
well, yeah, you know, I thought Michigan did a really good job of preventing interior cuts from actually getting to the player in question in the Loyola game. So, you know, they really thrive on driving and then dishing, and also Krutwig will actually have a number of assists where he finds guys on the inside. And every time they try that, it was like Charles Matthews or it was X, like, being in the right spot to force a turnover. I thought that actually, for the most part, held over for the Villanova game. You had Bridges get a dunk or two, but really they had to shoot for almost all of their makes, and that's what they did because they're Villanova. And Michigan was not that level of shooting team this year.
Hardly.
But I think we're covering ground we've already covered at this point.
734-998-1050. Let's go to the phones before we get to a break and talk to Don in Ann Arbor. Don, good morning.
Good morning, guys. I have a question for the basketball experts there. Two questions. A, how has Luke Jaklich's defensive approach affected the way John Beilein manages the offense? If there is an effect, I'm curious what the relationship between the two are. And B, Glenn Rice's tournament scoring record has stood for 29 years. Is that just a random statistical thing that doesn't have any real meaning one way or the other, or does it reflect some change in how college basketball is played now over the last 10 or 12 years in comparison with 1989?
That's a good question.
As far as the Glenn Rice question goes, I think that as coaches get a little more analytically oriented, you're seeing – huge usage guys kind of drop out and have lower usage on good teams. So Trae Young got in the tournament, and yes, he has huge usage, but, you know, his team was butt, so they didn't make it very far. And a team like Villanova, you go and you look at the KenPom, and even though Jalen Brunson is, like, the best player in the country, his usage is, like, 26%. It's not, like, 30%. It's not 32% or whatever Glenn Rice was back in 1989. Yeah. So I think that these days the good teams can't put that much – on one player's plate because it makes you not as good on offense.
There's one other thing. The line was a little shorter in 89.
It's true.
And so Rice was dealing with a shorter line, and obviously Rice was a phenomenal shooter. I mean, he's probably the best shooter who has ever been at Michigan that I can recall, and maybe one of the best shooters in the history of the Big Ten with maybe Alan Horniak and a couple other guys, but Horniak was 6'2", not 6'7". So, yeah.
Well, and Rice was ahead of his time.
Yeah.
So the kind of player he was, you know, these days you see a lot of Glenn Rices out there. But, you know, you get a 6'8 guy in 1989 who can just stroke it from three. Defenses didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah, the other thing is back in, I mean, when the three first came in, it was considered kind of an
unsporting act.
Yeah. almost so. I mean, that you said it right. And the three was considered sort of unmanly.
Yeah.
And on one hand, and it was also considered stupid. Why are you going to go out there and shoot from long distance when you can get the ball into the post?
Because you get 3 points instead of two.
Well, it took people a while to figure that one out. I mean, except for...
Yeah, I mean, like, how many Brady Hoke's are there in coaching? Brady Hoke's not going to go shoot threes in 1989.
Right. I mean, so it was only sort of people who could see the light from the beginning, guys like Beilein.
Well, I mean, so in Dean Oliver, Basketball on Paper, it's written, 20 years ago? But that was the first time he looked at these kind of offense, these offensive ratings that KenPom has on his site right now. And he was just shocked, like, how high the Reggie Millers of the world were.
Yeah.
And I think that started kind of the evolution of modern analytical basketball.
And that was 10 years after Glenn Rice did it.
Right, exactly right. So the basketball was slow to get it. And I guess but what about the other half of Don's question? Is there some negative synergy between good defense and good offense?
No, dude, this is about the personnel of this team, right?
I agree, you have
elite defenders in Simpson that struggle to shoot the ball, to say the least. I think Jokic has done a great job. I mean, if you remember 15 months ago, we were talking about how this team couldn't defend the dribble drive, and that's now become a strength of this team. You also have to give credit for this team. I'm just comparing Illinois State with last year from Michigan this year. In terms of forcing turnovers, this team is much better than that Illinois State team. You got to give a lot of credit to Simpson there. So I think he's taken advantage of his personnel, but also done a great job with teaching and just watching this defense has been amazing this year.
I mean, you don't often get college players who are both elite defenders and elite offenders. That's not a good word.
Offensive players. Only if they're steamed.
Right, yeah. But if you had a guy who was as good as Xavier Simpson on defense and could shoot, he wouldn't be in college for very long, right? So it's to have the kind of level of defense that Michigan had, you either have to have a bunch of five stars or you are making some sacrifices.
Or you just have Michigan recruited a couple guys like that. They're in the NBA right now. They finished the bridesmaid for Klay Thompson. He's like that. They recruited Kawhi Leonard. He's like that.
Right.
Kawhi Leonard, though, and Klay Thompson, I mean, aren't a lot of those dudes around.
There's always next year.
And those, by the way, when Michigan recruited, those weren't five-star guys.
Yeah. I remember.
Klay Thompson shot like 37% in college from three, right? Like, it's unbelievable what he's turned into.
Well, he did that at Washington State.
Right.
So
it should be easy. They don't play defense out in the Pac-10, 12, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Oh, just one final note. I mean, I think it was really good for college basketball to get a championship game between Michigan and Villanova. Two relatively clean programs. There were two minor mentions of Villanova in the FBI probe, which someone pointed out to me on Twitter.
Well, TBS disagreed with you.
The ratings, I haven't seen the ratings.
Ratings were not good.
Hey, they were the worst ratings ever.
They were bad.
We are talking about basketball purists here, Brian, and I think it's good for the
sport.
They
were the worst ever?
Oh, yeah.
Why would that be?
Colin Cowherd can have a jam session about it.
Wow, I didn't know they were
purity
that bad.
Purity of the game, Brian Cook. Well, purity of the game.
Let's make the game more pure by repealing all the rules.
it speaks to what I said before, and we got to get to a break about the FBI investigation in college basketball. I mean, people don't care.
No.
They don't care about the sport being clean.
I thought it was just Kentucky fans. No.
Well, I don't think they care because, paying people money for a good or a service is called capitalism, and a lot of other people participate in that system on a daily basis. But that's, whatever.
Markets? Free markets?
We get into some hockey talk. Michigan in the Frozen Four tonight. Miz, can you lay out our coverage?
Sure can. Coverage of the first game, Ohio State against Minnesota Duluth, will follow the conclusion of Detroit Tigers at Chicago White Sox if that game doesn't happen. 5:30 coverage for Westwood One right here on the ticket. And IMG coverage between Michigan and Notre Dame, 9 o'clock or after the conclusion of Ohio State-Michigan-Duluth, right here on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, the ticket.
All right, we got to get to a break. Come back on the other side. We'll start getting into the Notre Dame-Michigan matchup. So the Michigan Wolverines in the Frozen Four. Craig made the point before we got started with the roundtable that as improbable as the basketball run was, maybe the hockey run has been.
No, I refuse to countenance such a thing, because it's single elimination hockey, and anything can happen.
Just getting right, just getting basketball's got certain seed.
No, I mean like a 4-1. One seeds have like a 55% win record in the tournament in the first round over the past 13 years.
Yeah, that is pretty insane.
But we did end up getting a 2 seed. And could you tell me back in December this team was going to get a 2 seed in the...
Nope.
No.
Miz, I always had faith.
Thank you. Thank you, Miz.
I'm just being a realist on this side of the glass. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just I'm slightly trolling Sam.
Oh, okay.
About the game that he will not let drop in the tournament.
Yeah.
Which played out exactly as I had foreseen, except for the greatest goaltending performance in the history of the program.
Just as long as Sam wears his cup, it's all good. That's all matters.
Yeah, absolutely right. Brian.
I agree with you on that, Sam.
So now Brian, you're a hockey guy. Is it a thing? Do guys not wear cups in hockey?
I've never played hockey. So I mean,
you don't have to be play hockey to be a hockey guy. You watch hockey. You watch a lot of hockey.
I don't really look to see if everybody's wearing a cup.
I know you don't look to see if. Do you know if routinely guys don't wear cups in hockey?
I would assume the answer is no, because I have seen one hockey game in my entire life. And anybody who's seen one hockey game in their entire life, except for one Michigan player apparently, knows that of all the sports, the one that most demands the cup is hockey.
Yep.
You would think.
That's unanimous.
You would think.
Hey, Miz, you have that queued up. You still have that queued up over there.
I don't. I can get it re-queued back.
Don't worry about it.
Can you imagine what went through Mel's mind when he heard this? Like, he's walking into a new program. He's like, all right, we're gonna really improve this year. Like, what is the current state of our roster?
We don't have a cup, coach.
How many cups does the equipment man have?
I mean, but we were talking about it earlier. So I mean, what he was talking about in that particular line of questioning, they said, "Hey, Mel, you guys are blocking a ton of shots." And we talked about that on this show. I can't remember which series it was where that was like such a glaring stat. Was it the second Notre Dame series?
Something like that. Yeah.
Where there were a ton of blocked shots, and they said, "Mel, why are you so much better?" And he said, well, you know, it was a point of emphasis. You know, we weren't really good at it in the first half, so we really got on the guys about it. And he said, but one guy just wouldn't go down to block shots. And we kept trying to figure out why he wouldn't go down to block shots. And he said, believe it or not, the guy wasn't wearing a cup. And that's why he wasn't going down to block shots. And he says, so we got better once we started wearing cups.
Man, that's just like Major League when Wild Thing gets the glasses. You know, it's like, oh, it's a whole new player.
I mean, can you imagine? Hey, Ed. Get out on the ground and block shot. No, coach. No, I'm not doing that.
Nah, fam, I'm good.
I'm not doing that.
Because you know that he knew why he shouldn't do that. So in this guy's history, at some point, he had gotten a puck to the delicates, and that didn't change his mind. This is turning into the McElway hour.
But
so we gotta move on. We got serious things to talk about.
But it's real, though.
Sure, yeah.
It's real. But, you know, their defense is a lot better. His point, that was part of the change in the team. He said, you know, buy-in factor was huge. We already talked about that in a second. We'll have to dig back into it. Hayden Levine, that was the first series, that first Notre Dame series. That was when he got the keys.
Yeah.
Where he said, hey, no matter what happens, you have a bad goal, bad game, you're staying in there. And he said it kind of made him relax a bit, and he just went out there and played without – being worried.
You know, and his stats don't look particularly good, but if you separate out his save percentage into even strength and penalty kill, like the penalty kill is terrible. But as an even strength goalie, he's at like 925, which is pretty good. And earlier this year, you know, they were both kind of scuffling, and we weren't getting a lot of performance from either goalie. And now Levine has settled it.
I said I wouldn't do this, but there's an analogy here. When you're not looking over your shoulder, you play a little better. And for example, what team this year in basketball played six guys?
No, don't do this.
What team in basketball this year only? No, Villanova.
Syracuse did only
Villanova play six guys. They might have, but Villanova played six guys.
They played eight guys.
No, they played six.
They had two freshmen who played about 10 minutes a game.
Gillespie played 6 minutes in the semis, and they went with six guys. Look at the minutes. And it's a six-guy team, and no one's looking over their shoulder, and they had the right to miss. Never mind. I'm out of it. but it's the same in hockey. I agree.
You said you wouldn't do it.
I said I wouldn't do it. I should have.
But then you did it.
I did.
Oh, it's fine.
So let's dig into this matchup, because Michigan, they played Notre Dame amazingly tough in that first series, lost both games 2-1, then came back and swept Notre Dame when they played again. And it's like, man, you know, that was like the biggest weekend of the year at that point, up to that point.
Yeah, it was. That was when they went from I hope they can get on the bubble to I hope they don't blow this bid. And you know, the thing about both those series is that Notre Dame has 6 goals against Michigan this year. 5 of them are on the power play. They have 1 even strength goal against Michigan.
And, it's amazing.
You know, they're a very disciplined team, but they don't have loads of talent coming out of their ears.
So Michigan stays out of the box advantage. Michigan's going to win this game.
And you know, both of these, all 4 games were fairly low penalty because both these teams are very disciplined. And you know, Notre Dame doesn't really force you to take a lot of penalties just because they don't have a dynamic offensive talent. So given that, and given that, you know, whistles get pretty infrequent in playoff hockey, that does seem like advantage Michigan. And then the other thing that seems like advantage Michigan is we are witnessing Quinn Hughes blow up into a Hobie-level star. Now, he has to start converting some of that into actual points on his resume, but he's dominating games, and he's playing 25 to 30 minutes.
Is he back next year?
Probably. His size
will
probably leave him in college for another season, and also like the I don't even want to say it, but there is a possibility that his younger brother Jack Hughes will accelerate a year and come to Michigan.
Yeah, that's one of my trainers over body specs. Like, this kid is the truth.
He has 100 points as a U-17 at the National Development Program after getting called up.
Shout out to Joe. Joe was the first one to tell me about him.
And he's a lock to be the number one pick in the 2019 NHL draft. So you get those two guys on a team for a year, that might be a good year. So I think he's back. But for this Frozen Four, he's the best player in it by a mile. So Ohio State only has a couple of draft picks. Tanner Lozinski is a really good player.
By a mile.
Yes. Quinn Hughes is the best player in the Frozen Four by a country mile. I mean, he's going to be a top 5 NHL draft pick, and he toys with people out there. I mean, even in the tournament, like, you know, they're playing BU, and BU has a ton of really talented players on their team, and he is just killing them every time he's out there. So he's at another level. And he's like, Michigan has had some really talented guys play defense. Jake Trouba, Jack Johnson, Zach Werenski. And he is rapidly climbing my list of the best defensemen I've ever seen play for Michigan.
Yeah, he's a phenomenal skater and puck handler. There's
insane.
No question about it. And
my buddy who plays a lot of beer league hockey said he looked like a ringer out there. Like, he's playing in the Never Ever League.
at this level, except for the scoring, he looks like Bobby Orr.
What does his brother play?
He's a center.
Yeah, and you know, I thought your interview with Mel was really great. I was a little, I don't know what the word is, surprised, because it seems fairly obvious that Michigan is a good 5-on-5 team and a not great penalty, a power play team, and a terrible penalty kill team.
Yep.
And yet Mel was sort of discounting the penalty kill element.
See, I didn't think he was discounting it. I just think that he didn't get as candid on that as he did other things, because, you know,
there's no way that the number 57 penalty kill isn't killing him inside.
Yeah,
there's no way.
But it was I think his comment was, well, I've heard guys on your radio show complaining about it, or something like that.
Well, and, who could
and,
that be?
And I assume he's talking about mostly it, about Brian.
Pointing it out. It's a very bad penalty.
It was like when Bob Orr called my brother John the worst fan in the United States.
Come on.
I didn't take it like that.
Bob Knight.
I just think that, you know, it was a coach not harping on an obvious negative. That's how I took it.
Okay.
So.
But it really is. I mean, it's undeniable that this has been a problem this year, right? If you're number 57 in the penalty kill out of 60
teams.
Well,
I mean, I'll take you to the week before when we had I was talking to Billy McCault, and he said, look, we got to stay out of the box. We have got to stay out of the box. I mean, you could say that about any team.
But especially this team.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And they have accomplished that. They played Northeastern, and Northeastern has, I think, the third best power
scores,
play. They just leave their top guys out there for all 2 minutes. And I think they take two penalties in that game.
Exactly right.
Two. So they've done a really good job of not forcing referees to call stuff. And then, you know, if it's kind of ticky-tack, they're going to let it go in the playoffs. So I think that's a big advantage for Michigan because Notre Dame is a very disciplined team, but they don't have Quinn Hughes out there. And if someone's going to break a deadlock 5-on-5, it's probably going to be Michigan.
Yeah, I know anyone can win. You know, like you keep saying single elimination hockey, but who's the favorite in this field?
I don't really think there is one. Like, it feels really even to me. I think Vegas installed Notre Dame in as the favorite. And if you look at their season-long performance, they probably would be, but, you know, they had this great start, and then for the past 2 months, they've been scuffling.
I mean, we can't beat Ohio State, though, right? I mean, all year long we've struggled with
them. They are 0-5. Yeah. The last game was a 2-3 overtime game.
Yeah.
And then the crazy thing is when I was previewing that game, I went back and I was looking at, like, some more detailed stats on College Hockey News. And in terms of shot attempts, which is a thing that people like to use as a proxy for having the puck, Michigan dominated Ohio State in both of the most recent matchups. And that was a series at Ohio State, and they lose 4-0, but they outshoot Ohio State 32-20. Like, that's – and, you know, it's even worse for Ohio State if you look at shot attempts. So they've controlled possession and controlled shot attempts in the last three games against Ohio State. I'm relatively comfortable facing them for a national title, despite the fact that Michigan's 0-5 against them.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you the floor to share your analytics on the other side, Ed. You know, about this matchup, about the field, and also get you know, a brief take from Brian, because one of the things that Mel said that was very interesting was that, you know, hockey recruiting has changed.
It's wild.
Has really changed, and so I want to get into how.
We finally realized why one player wasn't blocking shots. He wasn't wearing a cup. If you can believe that. And we're wondering why he wasn't, you know, getting right down there and blocking shots. Well, you know why now. Anyway, it's been a better buy-in since we started wearing cups, I guess.
Smell piercing for hey, man. Look, the best comedy has a hint of truth. That had more than a hint of truth to it from Mel Pearson. All right, analytics guy, give us some hockey analytics.
Yeah, so thanks to a friend that gathered a bunch of data for me, I can do college hockey rankings now, and it essentially looks at goal rates adjusted for who you played. So similar to other things that I do in basketball. From that, you can figure out win probabilities. So I right now I can only do what's going to happen in regulation, and we're looking at Notre Dame 48% to win, Michigan 35%. The other is going at overtime. Pretty much corresponds to what Bovada has. I just pulled up some odds. Michigan has about a 41% win probability there. And then Ohio State and Minnesota Duluth are the two best teams in the Frozen Four. Ohio State with a ever so slight edge, which is also what the markets say. So, that's what the numbers say. I will be watching my first college hockey game tonight. So it's not like I cannot this year. So it's not like I can actually add some insight above that, which I like to do with basketball and football. Mm-hmm. But that's what the numbers say.
It's a shame.
What's a shame?
Because they don't have a space to argue.
Yeah.
Brian, I posed I set up a question before the break. How has hockey recruiting changed in the past 5-10 years?
Well, so a lot of the smaller schools are now almost exclusively recruiting guys who end up at college at 20 or even 21. And they've had a great deal of success leveling the playing field. And part of that was the fact that there were, you remember the snake oil thing with Rich Rodriguez mm-hmm. and Purdue? Mm-hmm. That was a real thing in college hockey for a long time, where like if you had a verbal commit, nobody else would talk to him. And so decommits were actually extremely uncommon in college hockey. and then they were having like one of their annual coaching meetups, and they're like, this is stupid. Let's not do this. Let's vote it down. And then all the coaches were like, no, we like to keep this, except for like five. And those five were like Minnesota and Boston College, because they're sick of this crap, right? Like, you know, we have these resources and we can't give them to these kids who are like 20 now and they've turned into really good players. And because you want to keep this archaic thing and you're exploiting the system, because, you know, it's not really good for college hockey if everybody who enters it is 20, because like most of these guys aren't going to play in the NHL. So they're entering the workforce a couple years later. It's just not pro player. And so that's kind of a rank hypocrisy. And we're going to get rid of this thing. And if you guys want to recruit a 20-year-old and we want to swoop in and be like, hey, buddy, why don't you play at Michigan instead of Alaska Anchorage or Fairbanks? And they're like, hey, that's actually a good idea. So Michigan has a kid named Jimmy Lambert who's already 21. And he's leading the BCHL in scoring. And he went back to the BCHL this year because – he was supposed to go to Alaska Fairbanks, and the coach got fired. And Michigan's like, that's mine now. And this is somewhat controversial because there's some sticks in the mud. But Mel's not putting up with any of that gentleman's agreement crap. And then he's being very, very aggressive down the road, which you have to be, because the other half of it is you're not just competing against college hockey players. I mean, teams, you're competing against the OHL, the WHL, and the QMJHL. Which are the three Canadian junior programs. So Michigan has a commit from an eighth grader born in 2004.
Good grief.
Who's got 90 points in 30 games for his middle school.
Thanks for making us feel old.
I saw a picture of him. It was terrifying. I'm like, I'm going to die right now. But, yeah, it's what you got to do. So Michigan doesn't know who on their commit list is going to the OHL and is just faking. They don't know who's going to decommit. They don't know who's going to leave for the NHL. So they have this incredible logistical puzzle of trying to have a good full roster every year without knowing half of what they need to know to actually fit all these guys in and not make some guys super pissed off.
tough to follow.
Yeah, it's good luck, everybody. But, you know, they had a couple guys in this class who were defenseman commits who were supposed to be at Tech this year, and then Mel left, and Tech didn't have room. And you'd think that would really like, be like, oh, that's I'm really pissed off at Mel Pearson. Both of them committed to Michigan. So, what are you? I don't know. They're doing a good job.
All right, folks, that'll do it for today's show. Hey, so does Michigan win it all?
Sure.
Hey. Sure, why not?
Great. I have to say yes or I'll be in trouble.
You're already in trouble.
All right. I'm sure you'll hear more on the game from Mike Spath coming up on Inside the Huddle. Stay tuned for that here. It's been great.
Better than us!